Hi, I'm Tara Lynn of Geek Saga Entertainment, and thanks for joining me for the Geek Saga Show. I am extremely excited for this episode as it features a very special guest for an interview on two things near and dear to both of our hearts, history and Red Dead Redemption. My guest, Tori Olson, isn't just a huge fan of the game. He's a professor at the University of Tennessee, where beginning in 2021, he taught the course Red Dead America, The Real History Behind the Hit Video Game. An experience that he used as basis for his upcoming book, Red History, A Video Game, An Obsession, and America's Violent Past. The book, which will be officially released on August 7th, even features an audiobook version narrated by Roger Clark, the actor who played none other than Arthur Morgan in Red Dead Redemption 2. And I was lucky enough to snag an early copy myself at SDCC last weekend, which I devoured in about 3 days. So, Tori, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Thank you so much, Tara, for inviting me to join for that introduction. Thanks so much for anyone who's tuning in to listen to us. It is a real pleasure to be here. Like Tara mentioned, my name is Tori Olson, and I am both a historian and a major fan of the Red Dead Redemption games. But, you know, being a historian makes that a very different kind of fandom, to be sure. My technical title is that I'm an associate professor of history at the University of Tennessee in Eastern Tennessee in the Southern Mountains in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I earned a PhD in history, was a history major. Tara and I have this in common. We established this very early on after we met. We have many, many commonalities, not just the fact that our names are four letters and begin with a T.
And have an R in the middle too. Like
that's true. There's a great deal of similarity here. Yeah, so I'm the author of this new book, Red Dead's History, which is coming out in just a few days. And really eager to talk about the surprising ways that video games, and even violent video games, can actually serve as a gateway to learning big things, especially to delving with the intricacies of American history, which is, of course, the setting of the Red Dead Redemption games, this kind of turn of the century, late 19th, early 20th century moment. So thrilled to be here.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, I'm Tara. You can find me at A Geek Saga on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Threads, and Twitter. Additionally, I just want to mention the Geek Saga Entertainment Patreon. We have 10 tiers ranging from $1 a month to $40 a month. It's a great way to support us and receive some fun perks in return, including early access to the podcast version of this episode and early access to my other podcast-only series, including Hot D Takes, which is on HBO's House of the Dragon, and my solo podcast series, Impulsive Hyperfocus. You can find my Patreon at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment. Now, I'm going to try to keep this interview as organized as possible, but it's also meant to be a fun discussion. So bear with us as we kick it off with some of Tori's thoughts on playing Red Dead, followed by his experiences teaching his course at the University of Tennessee, and then his thoughts on writing Red Dead's history. So let's get into it. Just starting with gameplay, do you think as a professor of history and history lover that you felt more of a connection to the Red Dead games than to other games you've played?
Well, so I play games primarily on Steam, and Steam very visibly tallies the hours that you've spent in games. And it is very true that I have played Red Dead Redemption 2 more than any other game that I own. That's not all that surprising, given that I've devoted like 3.5 years of my life to many ways, right? So I have a very special connection with Red Dead 2. I'll confess, I have not played Red Dead 1. I have watched it. I've watched several playthroughs on YouTube. It doesn't quite give you the same immersion, obviously, as playing a game three times all the way through, as I have with Red Dead 2. But I do have a very special connection with them. So to understand my connection with video games, just a quick bit of personal history here.
Yeah.
I was a huge gamer in high school, like in middle school and high school. That was a while ago. That was in the late 1990s. And in that era, I was a huge PC gamer. I played a lot of Half-Life, Doom, Quake, Warcraft, Wolfenstein, all the classics from that period. But between the years 2000 and 2020, I really didn't play any video games at all. When I started college, I basically quit video gaming cold turkey. It was not doing me any favors academically. And I decided to get serious about life, right? And I kept up that pledge for 20 years. Went to graduate school, you know, earned a PhD, became a junior professor, and didn't play hardly anything at all. But then, of course, comes the pandemic in 2020. And so basically for the last 4 years, I've been playing video games again. And Red Dead 2 was one of the very first games that I picked up. Is it my favorite game that I've ever played? It's like in a separate category, you know, because it's not just leisure and recreation, professional, you know, engagement. It's work, it's writing, it's teaching. But that makes me love it all the more, nevertheless.
Obviously, you had this special connection with this game, but what are a couple of other games that you've loved?
Don't get me started, because we'll spend the whole interview talking about that. The very first game that I played, starting in March of 2020, like as soon as the pandemic started, lockdowns began, was another big, complicated, storytelling, open-world game. Not so historical, though. It was The Witcher 3. And The Witcher 3 is like really what got me back into video games, because I was like absolutely floored by what was possible in a video game. You know, keep in mind that like the last game I played before Witcher 3 was like Deus Ex from 1999, which is like an amazing video game, but very, very juvenile and unsophisticated compared to The Witcher 3. Mm-hmm. I think my favorite games that I've played in the last 4 years, like since I've kind of reconnected with my gamerdom, I like Cyberpunk 2077 too, which, you know, because I love Witcher 3, so I went for that one. I'm currently playing and so obsessed with Elden Ring, which, you know, is dangerous. It's kind of hard. I love Disco Elysium. I played that earlier this spring. It was just beautiful, so funny and hilarious and smart. There's a lot of games that I've loved. Yeah. But those are kind of the tops. All very different, of course.
The Red Dead series is definitely just my all-time favorite, period. But I've played a little bit or a lot of quite a few other games. Not so much recently because I haven't had time. But also, you mentioned that you haven't played Red Dead 1. And to be fair, I will say that until the remastered quote-unquote version came out last year, it really was not widely available. You had to have the PlayStation Online network.
I didn't have the hardware, you know. Yeah. I would have played it, but I had to like track down a PS3, like no.
yeah exactly.
I'm a latecomer to the party. Like, I didn't play any Red Dead games until 2020. Mm-hmm. I've made up for lost time, obviously, right? I've spent a lot of time investigating them and thinking about them since then. But, you know, there's people who have 15 years of experience who start with Red Dead Revolver and then went with John Marston and Red Dead Redemption, the original, and then, you know, it was kind of old hat in 2018 when Red Dead 2 came out. Mm-hmm. I'm not that person, but I like to think, again, that I've made up for lost time and I'm still pretty savvy about the games and, of course, the larger historical world that they kind of resurrect or, yeah, you know, recreate or try to recreate.
Well, listen, no gatekeeping here, honestly. Like, I was actually trying to say, unless you played Red Dead, the first Red Dead years ago, it's been basically impossible to play it until they came out with that quote-unquote, right, I keep saying that, remastered or whatever they called it.
I hear it's coming out for PC pretty soon. Yeah. And since PC is still my favorite platform, I will play it. I'll play it all the way through on that system.
It's definitely worth it, even as just a comparison thing, honestly. Yeah. So,
you know, I have opinions on that game based on my watching of playthroughs. And I do think it is, I might offend people here, but I think it is the inferior game to Red Dead 2. I really think everything that Red Dead 1 does well, Red Dead 2 does better. So, and my book, another spoiler alert here, my book is primarily overwhelmingly about Red Dead Redemption 2. Really about the storyline mode of Red Dead 2. Not so much Red Dead Online, and not so much the first game, and definitely not Red Dead Revolver, unfortunately, which I think I've not played.
I played very little of Red Dead Revolver, so I'll mention that in a minute. But getting back to Red Dead, let's get the basics out of the way. Outside of the big three, because I can't give you an easy, super easy question to answer. So outside of the big three, Arthur, John, and Dutch, of course, who are your top three characters from the Red Dead games? Well, I guess from Red Dead 2, since it's the only
So in my book, Arthur probably gets the most space in terms of quotes and things like that, you know, characters that I engage as lenses to understand history. You know, I have a very special relation with Arthur, obviously, right? He's mm-hmm. Roger is also who narrated the audiobook. So, you know, that's undeniable. I'd say my top character that I'm most fascinated with as a historian and as a gamer is Charles Smith, who's just opened such interesting windows in thinking about race and indigeneity and different perspectives on the West. And I was really, really thrilled that this past weekend in San Diego at Comic-Con, I got to meet Nasheer Dalal, who plays mm-hmm. Charles Smith. I got to give him an autographed copy of the book, which was amazing. And I'm so eager to hear what he thinks of it, because I do a lot with his character, you know, with mm-hmm. Charles Smith in the game. So Charles gets a lot of quotation space in this book because he's a smart guy. He says interesting things.
Yeah.
And he reflects, you know, on his native background, on his African-American background. And yeah, he's just like always in the right place at the right time for saying something interesting about stuff. besides him, I really like Javier Escuela too. I'm partially a historian of Mexico as well. My first book was really about Mexico and the Mexican Revolution. And this was my favorite part of Red Dead 1 was it's the place of Mexico and the revolution in 1911. So Javier is like an interesting character as well because, you know, he's an outlaw and he's a bandit, but he's an immigrant and he's this guy who's kind of different than some of the camp members. I mean, I think he's the only Spanish-speaking member of the camp, if I'm not wrong. But yeah, he's just a fascinating character. And then let's see, I'll add one more, Tilly Jackson. Tilly Jackson is so cool. And a lot of this is, I've always loved Tilly, but then I met Mia Davis, who plays her at Deadwood at the convention recently. And I just thought she was so amazing and so funny and brilliant that I was like, well, Tilly's even cooler now than she was before.
Next up, what area of the map is your favorite to play in and or explore and why?
That has a very easy answer for me, because there's one area of the map that really convinced me to teach the class and to write the book. And that is the state of Lemoyne, the southeastern, you know, state that has Saint-Denis within it. We haven't talked about this before, but, you know, when I picked up Red Dead 2 in early 2020 during the pandemic, I didn't do so for like professional reasons. I did so for fun. I heard the game had great graphics. I heard it had a very HBO-like storyline. Both of those things are totally correct, right? It was a brilliantly written game and the graphics are insane, even 5 years after release. So I picked it up for fun. And my primary training as a historian, the field that I really kind of specialize in, is Southern history. I live in the South. I did my PhD in the South at the University of Georgia. My first book was half Mexico and half about the U.S. South. So, like, I've read a lot of Western history. I've read a lot more in the last 4 years, to be sure, as I've done this project. But Western history was kind of like a side field for me. So when I pick up the game and start playing, I'm like, you know, everyone says it's a Western too, right? I just imagine the whole game would be set in the West. I was surprised quite soon that that was not the case. But it's about 15 to 20 hours into the storyline when the gang is forced to flee their camp in whatever it's West Elizabeth or New Hanover, you know, the kind of Western portions of the map. Mm-hmm. And once you move into Lemoyne, it was like when I walked into the town of Rhodes and saw the way that it portrayed like the plantation south in the 1890s, that's when a switch flipped inside of my head. And I thought, wait, I could do a class about this. Like, this is not just Western history. This is also Southern history. And that was the real moment. And then it moved into Appalachia, you know, the Southern mountains. And that's another place I know a great deal about. So that was when things clicked. So a lot of my class and a lot of the book, it's a balance of, yes, the West, but then the South and Appalachia. Mm-hmm. And in my class, the Caribbean and Mexico during the Mexican Revolution. So Lemoyne is my favorite. It's just so interesting. It's so well, I mean, all parts of the map are beautiful and have their amazing storylines and missions and all that. But Lemoyne is special to me. Saint-Denis is special to me.
Yeah, Saint-Denis is very special to me for a lot of reasons.
Even, you know, I played the game for 200 hours, which there's many people out there who play far more than that. But for me, that's a lot of hours. Even after 200 hours, like when I walk into Saint-Denis still, I feel like a little shiver down my spine when I see the smokestacks belching black smoke into the sky, like the cotton piled up on the docks. You know, it's a beautifully depiction of a city at that moment in time. So to me, it's one of the best rock star cities of all time. And, you know, it's not the first. There's been several before.
My first playthrough alone, I put in at least 170 hours. I did not get 100% completion. I got something like 87 or 89%. But yeah, it was a lot of time. So following up on that, I have to ask, and this is in the gameplay and plot sense only, how do you feel about Guarma? Having to go there, what happens there, how short of a time is spent there, stuff like that.
Yeah. I know from reading blogs online and, you know, gaming websites and things like that, that a lot of people don't like Guarma, that they think it kind of sticks out like a sore thumb, you know, it's so different and it's kind of this brief interlude. I really like it. I mean, I like it as a gamer and as a historian, right? I like it as a gamer because it's cool. Like, it's a totally different biome, if you will. You know, there's some interesting missions. You got to recover your gear. You know, your gangmates are all kind of dispersed. But as a historian, I love it because it helps broach this major question, which is American imperialism, right? So this game is set in 1899. Well, in 1898, the U.S. invades Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, Hawaii. It's this massive moment of kind of imperial expansion, which the game, you know, in the Guarma chapters gets at a little bit. But one of the great sort of tragedies in many ways of the book is that I actually don't do anything with Guarma in the book. Right. I wish I had the space to do so. In a perfect world, I would have devoted like 3 or 4 chapters on Guarma and about kind of American expansionism in the 1899 moment. But I like Guarma. Yeah, I think it's cool. I think the game would be weaker without it.
I only wanted to ask, obviously I know having read now that you didn't really touch on it at all, but I wanted to ask because I am one of those people who the reason I don't like it is because I feel like it felt like it was an unfinished part of the game. Like, because you spend so little time there, you can drag it out as much as you want, but you still spend so little time there. So that's like why I don't like it. Not because I feel like it was necessarily a bad decision to have the characters go there. Yeah. And I do think there is some meaning for sure behind that, especially in the time frame that the game is set in, but too short.
Yeah, but let's say you spend 10 hours there, you know, that's probably what I spent my first playthrough. You get new perspective on the mainland map. Everything kind of looks a little different. You're like really happy to be back in many ways. Like,
yeah,
to me, it kind of gave new sparkle to old destinations that I'd been treading over before.
Okay, last but not least, before we get into our next section, what are your favorite and least favorite encounters and things to do in the game? And I'm thinking of, like, in terms of encounters, like running into Nigel on his search for Gavin or helping the suffragettes, things you don't have to do, but you can do. And then in terms of just general things to do, hunting and or fishing, playing cards or dominoes or five finger filet, hanging out in camp and wandering around, listening, dropping eaves into people's conversations and whatnot.
That I love. The kind of slow moments in camp, those are some of my favorite, you know, episodes in the game. That's when you catch the sort of depth of what the writers and developers of this game wanted, especially regarding history, right? So, like, I love the moment when you catch Uncle in camp. I don't know if you saw this, Tara, but, like, he's reading a newspaper and he's like, what are we doing in the Philippines? Like, why are we fighting a war in the Philippines? You know, so that's a great moment. It's brief, but it's, you know, shows the kind of global awareness of what's going on. Or like Lenny talking about his enslaved father and about, you know, the experiences of slavery by 1899 and the sort of memories of this stuff. Like, that's brilliant. You know, there's really great moments in there. I never gambled. Literally, I've never spent a single minute gambling.
There might be one time where you're forced to do it if you get into, probably more than one time where you're forced to do it if you get into certain side missions. But unless I was forced to do it, I did not choose to.
I did not play Gwent in Witcher 3, and I did not play poker in Red Dead Redemption 2.
Or dominoes or five-finger filet.
It's just,
I don't understand why people like playing five-finger filet.
I'm not a gambler. I've actually, it's funny, like, I met you in Deadwood, South Dakota, and there's gambling everywhere. Did I partake? No, I'm not really a gambler.
I've aged out of it a little bit now, and I'm not saying I'm old. I'm just saying I'm at this point in my life where it's not the place I want to go, but I've been to Vegas like 24 times, and I am not at all a gambler. So, but the difference is there's a ton of other food and dancing and drinking and all that stuff, you know, sightseeing to do in Vegas. But yeah, no, I agree. What about encounters before we move on? Any specific, not necessarily side missions, but just things you kind of happen to run into and get involved in?
My book and my class draw upon so many different moments in the game to kind of explore the sort of real history that the game sort of gestures toward. And some of the moments are kind of like main storyline mission moments, but then some of them are these kind of passing encounters. There's one small encounter that provides actually the foundation of a whole chapter in here, which is the encounter that you have in Rhodes with this African-American doctor named Dr. Renault. You happen upon, and he's had these, you know, kind of white good old boys steal his medicinal wagon. And he's explaining to Arthur what happened. And he mentions that, you know, these guys had like threatened to do these horrible punishments to him, you know, to like crucify him and do all this sort of thing. And as far as I know, that is the closest reference the game makes to the institution of lynching, the sort of like mass mob murder of primarily African-American men in the South. It's not exclusively a Southern institution, but by 1899, it is overwhelmingly a Southern institution. And that is a reference that's really powerful to me because the 1890s was the worst decade of lynching in American history. The 1890s claimed more victims in that decade than any other decade in the U.S., in American history, in Southern history. Yeah. So I use that kind of, you know, 20-minute, 25-minute mission to thread out a much broader discussion of what was lynching. What were these horrific, nightmarish threats that this Black man who was competing with white doctors or whatever that he faced? So it provided me this amazing opportunity to kind of look at something that the developers were just tiptoeing around. And I understand why, you know, like, it's incredibly painful and very sensitive subject to talk about. But they made enough reference there that I was like, okay, well, let's talk about what this institution was actually like.
Since you've mentioned your class quite a few times, and obviously I brought it up at the very beginning. So Tales from the Classroom, In the preface of the book, Red Dead's History, you mentioned that your class announcement from Twitter made its way to Reddit, where it found a wide audience and garnered some strange comments. As a regular Reddit user and a subreddit mod myself, let's just say I have plenty of experience with interesting Reddit posts and comments. So I have to ask, do you recall any of these comments in particular? Does anything?
Oh, yes.
Hopefully not terrible memories of them, but you know.
No. It was fun. I mean, you know, online comments are, you know, well, behind the veil of anonymity. Mm-hmm. People will really say things that they don't care what people think, or sometimes that they don't even believe. And let's be honest, some of these comments could actually be coming from like Russian bots that are trying to foment, you know, division in the United States. You never know what exactly is real or not.
Yeah.
But there was a pattern. I posted this thing on Twitter, basically like, I'm doing a class on the real history portrayed in Red Dead Redemption 2. Here's some topics I'll cover. And then someone else, not me, put that tweet on Reddit, and it it was even more viral on Reddit than it was on Twitter, which was amazing. I'd not used Reddit before that time, but I got interested in it because of that.
Yeah.
The most common negative strange comment were people who wanted to dump on college education in the United States. They wanted to talk about, wow, this is a perfect example of the uselessness of American colleges and universities, because look at this professor, he's teaching a class about a fictional video game. They didn't get the part that, no, I'm not teaching the content of Red Dead 2 that is made up, right? There are no quizzes in my class about, like, who is a member of the Vanderlyn gang, right? And maybe I wasn't explicit enough in my tweet. What I'm doing is just using the fictional content of the games as a hook, you know, as a lens to then explore the much bigger thing beyond it. And the plan back then, and what ended up happening, was really that 90% of our time in the classroom was spent talking about real history. The classes all began with a hook from the game. You know, I'll show clips from a mission, or, you know, sometimes briefly play the game in class with the students. But the point was not to learn about Micah Bell. The point was to learn about John D. Rockefeller and Ida B. Wells and, like, you know, the major figures and actors and characters that shaped American history in that, you know, late 1800s moment. So, yeah, a lot of people were just like, this is the perfect example of why I'm never going to college. However, they were definitely outbalanced, like 5-1, by the people who were like, I'm applying to the University of Tennessee right now.
Listen, if I could have, I'm blanking on the term, but what is it called when you don't even go to the school, but you can like take that
auditing.
One course? Auditing. Yeah. Thank you. I was like, I know it starts with an A. Why am I blanking on this? If I had known about this, because when I said, oh, I know, it's because I Googled. After reading, you know, the first part of the book, like I just Googled Red Dead's history or maybe I Googled University of Tennessee class, whatever, Reddit. And there were a ton of posts about it. Actually, some of them were from you later after the book was, you know, being published and everything. You know what I mean? Like when you're in the process of getting the book published. But the first one had like 400 plus comments. And I was like, I don't have time.
I read like a quarter of them, maybe even half of them. Soon enough, you see patterns start to repeat and you're like, okay, I kind of get
that. Okay,
but the general reaction was enthusiasm. Oh, I wish I had that when I was in college, or, you know, like, how do I transfer to UT or whatever? I'll tell you, Tara, it made those comments and all the kind of publicity that came from that early tweet was a huge part of why the class became a book.
Oh,
because like you said, I got messaged by all these people who were like, how do I audit your class? Dozens and dozens of messages in my inbox. How can I access? Is it on Zoom? Can I do, you know, it's still pandemic times, right? And I had to send the same disappointing message to every one of them, which is, sorry, you need to be enrolled at University of Tennessee and you need to be in person Tuesday and Thursday at 2:30 or whatever, you know, and they can't do that when they're coming from Turkey or China or, you know, France or whatever. But at the end of the class, right, when I'm sitting at the end of the semester, I've got this big stack of lectures, you know, that I've worked my tail off to prepare. And I got all those other messages in my inbox. I'm thinking, well, why not convert this class into a book? You know, why not repackage the sort of thinking and journey that I took my students on and make it accessible to a much wider audience? Like make this engaging, fast-paced, and meaningful to people both who love history in this period, but then people who love the game, right? You know, the Red Dead heads, as I often call them, like the people who really, you know, who've spent way more time than me playing the games and are really curious to use them as a vehicle for, you know, understanding bigger things about the United States.
I'm over here like, guilty. I could also picture this, the story of this game, particularly if you dive into a lot of little side stories being used in a literature class, just saying.
Oh, yeah. I think there's a high school literature class that uses Red Dead 2 in some way, which is awesome. You know, using this game in the high school classroom is trickier, mainly because the game is rated 17 plus, you know, so that does disqualify everyone but seniors basically for
it. Listen, I know what my 17-year-old stepkid watches on TikTok. They're seeing way worse. I mean,
the high school kids are all playing it. We all know that. Yeah. But for a teacher to defend it before the administration, before parents, it's dicier. I mean, for me as a university instructor, it's a lot easier because I don't field emails from angry parents. I have tremendous leeway and liberty in teaching what I want to teach, you know, as long as it's meaningful and it's factually accurate. I'm liberated in ways that many high school teachers are. So I have a lot of respect for those high school teachers who are out there teaching any history, but those who are thinking about using Red Dead in the classroom, because I think there's possibilities. I think this book could work in that context. It would just have to be in the right setting.
Okay, so we might get into this a little bit more in the next section when we dive more into the book itself. But as it was based on the class you taught, I'm assuming your class also covered most, if not all, of the plight of Black people in the South, not just slavery, but post-Civil War lynchings, chain gangs, and the advent of Jim Crow. And as someone who lived in the South for nearly two decades myself, and seeing as you teach at a school in the South, I'm curious as to whether you ever experienced pushback when delving into these topics. Like, I'm not even saying just from the administration, and I know there might be things that you can't say or whatever, but students, you know, who were kind of like, oh, this isn't what I expected. I didn't expect to be learning about this specific thing and being told this specific thing that I don't want to hear. King Cotton and all that.
That's a great question. So obviously, Southern history is a really crucial part of Red Dead Redemption 2's storyline, right? So much of it is in the South. And you cannot understand Southern history at any moment, but especially in the late 1800s, if you don't consider African-American history, right? So I knew that African-American history in the South would be really crucial to this book and the class, of course. It is a major part of it. But of course, it's a major part of the game too, right? You know, like lots of your storyline missions are spent with Charles and with Tilly and with Lenny and other people. I mean, I think the single most, if there's one single word that sums up this game more than any other, it's Lenny. Not that that itself is African-American history, but you know, Black characters are really, really crucial to the storyline of the game. So I place them at front and center in the book. Mm-hmm. They're not the only protagonists, right? That's certainly not true, but they're very, very important. So I teach in the South. Obviously, I've been teaching in the South for 19 years at this point, right? First in Georgia and then in Tennessee. And I do delve into questions of regional history all the time. Do I get students, you know, being like, wow, I've never heard it taught that way? Yeah, all the time. I teach questions of the Civil War and slavery, right? And I think as just about every university history professor does, I place slavery at the very center of what caused the war and how to understand its aftermath, right? The emancipation of slavery is just a revolutionary consequence of the Civil War. So that's a story that a surprising number of Americans and Southerners in particular, but not just Southerners, had not grown up with, right? They'd grown up, no, this is the Civil War was caused by states' rights. You know, it's like an ideological struggle about small government and all this sort of thing. And I mean, I can go into the depth of why that's wrong in so many ways.
The book does that a little bit, so I don't think you have to. No spoilers.
That's right. Yeah. Don't want to spill all the beans. But I know I have students who are really kind of like, wow, this is a fundamentally different version of Southern history. Forget about the Civil War for a second. The 1890s, like that's a decade that very few people know about in Southern history. But it's actually like, I would say the third most important decade in Southern history. I would say the 1860s and the 1960s, right? Mm-hmm. Civil War and civil rights are probably the most two influential decades. But the 1890s, I would place as a third because there's so many things that happened during that decade. For example, right, I already mentioned that lynching kind of hits its bloody crescendo during those years. During the 1890s is when you see the Confederate battle flag being placed on state flags for the first time ever. Had not been done previously. It's when you see monuments, like big public monuments being constructed to the Confederacy. All those monuments that have been debated and many of them torn down in the last 5-6 years, those were not built right after the Civil War. They're built during the 1890s. That's when it starts, and then continuing into the first two decades of the 20th century. So 1890s is also the decade when Jim Crow laws, like segregation laws and disfranchisement laws, are first passed systematically in the South. It's when Plessy versus Ferguson happens, the Supreme Court case that basically greenlights racial segregation. All this stuff is happening in the 1890s, and Red Dead 2 somehow provides me this amazing opportunity to teach about it, because even though the game doesn't place that stuff front and center, it gestures toward it many, many times in the game. So it allows me an opportunity to kind of use that fictional content, to use characters like Lenny and Tilly and others to examine what that looks like. Like, why are there statues in the middle of roads in Saint-Denis? What do those statues mean? Why did someone scratch coward on that statue in Saint-Denis? You know, the game alludes to these things. Like, on its own, the game is not going to teach you all the intricacies of the 1890s in the South. Red Dead 2 is not an edutainment title. It is an entertainment title. Yeah. But with a little bit of accompaniment, your favorite game can actually be a window to learning things, not just that are historical, but that really shape the world we live in today. The America of the 2020s, we really can't understand unless we understand that kind of late 1800s moment. So
I don't want to get too deep into the book just yet, which we already kind of have, but I will mention that its focus is almost entirely, like 99.5% at least, on comparing RDR2 to history. However, I saw it noted a few places that your class did in fact include teachings on the first / original Red Dead Redemption. If that was the case, can you, I guess, briefly touch on a few of the things you taught surrounding the first main game? And yes, I know Red Dead Revolver is technically included in the Red Dead games and came first, but as we know, that's a different sort of game, so we're not going to get into it.
Right.
I'm putting that in there for the people who are like, but Red Dead Revolver, and it's like, yes, I know it exists. I've played a little bit of it, but it's not a full game like these are.
Yeah, for sure. No, let me address it, because I do think that hardcore fans of the original Red Dead Redemption, who maybe didn't like the second game, might be a little peeved with my book that, you know, their favorite title didn't get quite the front row and center treatment. And I apologize to you. I'm sorry. This first game has strengths, to be sure. I think my real sort of criticism of that game would really turn me off to it more. I mean, obviously, like, the graphics are a lot worse, but it's not fair to compare it, you know, because it came out like 12 years ago or something.
Yeah.
No, 14 years ago.
14.
I think the real thing that sticks with me is that the only characters in the first game who really got nuance and complexity and like many different sides, they're all white men. And, you know, they're very interesting white male characters. John Marston, you know, his cowboy buddy down in Mexico.
Hey now. Bonnie McFarlane is a white woman.
It's true. Let's
at least give it that.
I don't know. Maybe she has more complexity than I grant her.
It could depend on what playthroughs you watched, honestly.
Yeah, for sure. The game deserves more credit than I give it. And I'll say the one thing that it does really well that Red Dead Redemption 2 does not engage is the place of Mexico. Mm-hmm. Because when it comes to like Hollywood Westerns, so many of them are actually Northerns because they play out in Northern Mexico, you know, which is not the West, it's the North. And they take place, you know, south of the border, as they say. And Red Dead 1, of course, pays homage to those Mexican outings of those Hollywood classics. But it's not just a Western, or so, you know, like a Hollywood Mexican movie. It's a particular kind of setting because it's set in the Revolution, the Mexican Revolution, which begins in 1910 with the plot of the coup against Porfirio Diaz, this dictator who'd been in power for 30 some years at that time. It's so fascinating to me that they set Red Dead 1 at that moment, you know, because the Mexican Revolution is this huge moment in global history. It's the first social revolution of the 20th century. And in that sense, it really sort of sets the stage for other major social revolutions of the 20th century. So like the Soviet Revolution, just later in that same decade, the Chinese Revolution in the 1940s, the Cuban Revolution of the 1950s and 60s. So it's this major kind of like blockbuster moment in world history. And Red Dead 1 gets at some of the tensions within it, you know, that you have this sort of peasant uprising from below, challenging this local strongman who's serving under this really dictatorial president. The game does a pretty decent job getting at some of the sort of dynamics of it. Does it essentialize it? Does it simplify it a whole lot? Yeah, of course it does. Does it portray the Mexican characters in a particularly good light? No. The Mexican characters really rub me the wrong way. I mean, they spoke decent Spanish. You know, I can assert that. I do speak Spanish myself too. Their Spanish is okay, but their characters are such stereotypes. You know, it's just like the angry, cigar-smoking, gringo-hating bad guy. It's like, oh, really? Are we doing this again? You know, given that the Rockstar remastered Red Dead 1 recently, I don't think they changed any of those characters is a little surprising to me because
no, they did
kind of offensive. You know, they're just yeah. they're not horrible. They're not the worst of the worst, but like they're really unpleasant. I don't think a lot of Mexican gamers would see those characters and like, yeah, that's yeah. me. You know, like nah.
Well, and I mean, and Javier Escuela is better in the first Red Dead, but also like you said, he was one of your favorite characters in Red Dead 2, and like coming into Red Dead 2 having played Red Dead 1, I was kind of like. Mm.
Yeah,
this but guy,
he has substance. Like,
right? No, he does.
In the second game, he just has nuance, right? Like, mm-hmm. he's not this flat guy who's like dictated by where he's from and like
yeah.
that he's a man and that he has a you turn him one way and he looks a little different. So I think he's better.
Yeah, I mean, listen, none of them are good guys. Let's be real.
Charles Smith is kind of a good guy.
Yeah, yeah, he's probably the best of them all. On another note, I know, and this is the last question I have about like you teaching your class. I have specific questions about your experiences writing the book, but I know that Roger and Rob visited your class, and that must have been just an absolutely amazing experience for you and your students. So I definitely talk about that if you want to, but also like setting that aside, what is your other favorite memory or are your other favorite memories from teaching the class?
Yeah, I'll share the class crashing day and then I'll share my other favorite moment. So class crashing day first was like literally one of the most hilarious, amazing, mind-blowing days of my entire life.
How did that come about, by the way, if you don't
mind asking? Yeah, of course. Yeah. Okay, so this past semester, spring of 2024, I taught Red Dead America for the third time. Right, so it was the third time I was doing it. By this point, I'd pretty much finished writing the book. I knew much more about the class. I was probably the best version of it that I taught, in my opinion. This class runs from January to May, right? The usual spring semester in the college year. But by the time the semester started, I was already hooked in with Roger Clark. So it was November of last year that my publisher, and I'm still just like thanking the heavens for the fact that they were able to pull this off, they secured Roger to be the narrator of the audiobook, right? And this was like a dream that I could never have imagined.
Oh, it's amazing.
A year or two earlier, right? It just seemed so impossible, but somehow it happened. And I'm tremendously honored and delighted to be partnered with Roger on this. He's just an amazing guy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was connected with him already. Like I had his email address. We've been swapping messages. And then at the very beginning of the semester, like in January, I saw on Facebook that Roger Clark and Rob Weedoff, who plays John Marston in both the games, was coming to Knoxville already for a gaming convention for the Fanboy Expo. It was taking place right before spring break, right before we have spring break here.
Oh my God.
And I had this crazy idea pop into my head, right? Like I'm teaching this class. I have 75 students signed up. I already have a relationship with Roger. So I think like, well, let's try to get them to come to my class. But I didn't want to tell my students anything. So I kept it totally hush hush. But I made an invitation to Roger and then through him to Rob to like, they obviously knew about the class at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, Roger had read the whole book, I think, by this point, and asked them, you know, hey, you guys want to come and just like pop in unannounced to class? But the danger was that because this class session was right before spring break, the attendance tends to be rather low on those days, right? Students are like already down in Panama City Beach, you know, drinking. I feel really bad about this. I lied to my students. I said, you have to come this Thursday because there's going to be a quiz. It's going to be really important. I think I said it was going to count double or something for their grade. And they're like, oh, you know, quiz. So that when the day came,
bad professor.
Good at playing that card, by the way. On the day of the class, I basically had Roger and Rob like in my back pocket. I mean, they were in the hallway, they were waiting outside. And I came in, I told the students, you know, guys, good news, there's actually not a quiz. And they're like, what the hell, man? You know, like, what are you doing? And I said, instead, we're going to have two outside experts come join us and talk about gamifying the past. And I'm sure that they were thinking like, oh, you know, Olson's bringing in outside experts. It's probably some professor buddies of him. And then I tell them like, well, our two experts are Roger Clark, who played Arthur Morgan, and Rob Weedoff, who played John Marston. And they just lost it. You can actually watch this for yourself.
I did see the video on Reddit, but like, to be honest, I almost feel like it didn't actually lend credence to like how those kids reacted.
I'll tell you a story that's not captured on the video, which I wish had come through. When I said Roger Clark, who played Arthur Morgan, one student said, oh shit. Very audibly, you know. And what's funny is that the day afterward, he emailed me and he's like, Professor Olson, you know, I'm so sorry I said oh shit in class. You know, I know that's totally, you know, rude or something. And I'm laughing, of course, because I'm like, dude, that was amazing. That was exactly the response that I wanted. You know, like, what do I expect you to sit there and just kind of like, you know, oh, whatever, this isn't cool. No, I want you to say, oh shit.
I will say this too, like Roger and Rob are so, all of the actors are so just in tune with and amazing with their fans, right?
They really are. I don't think every game is like this or every actor.
I don't know. I've been to a lot of conventions. I have moderated some really harsh panels where it was very clear that the person I was moderating for did not want to be there. Don't get me wrong. Those are probably the minimum of panels I've moderated with actors, but they do happen. And then they're the people who are there and they're like interacting as much as they have to. And they're nice and everything. But like, I feel like, especially having gone to Tombstone last year and being in Deadwood this year, every one of these actors, they are in love with the thing that they were part of creating and they love each other and they are so, so appreciative and great with their fans. And it doesn't surprise me in the least that Roger and Rob were like, yeah, we'll do it.
As soon as they got the invitation, they're like, oh yes, this is great. We love it. It required a great deal. Like Rob Weedoff, he lives in Indiana and he drove to Knoxville, which is like, I don't know, 6-7 hour drive or something. And he had to drive back because he had to work on Friday.
Oh,
but he literally drove to
Knoxville,
hung out with our class, drove back to Indiana, and then the following day returned to Knoxville for the convention. Not only did he take the team, he drove for like more than 10 hours to do this.
Oh my God.
So that, you know, Rob is just such a sweetheart. He's one of the really most genuine and kind and giving individuals I've pretty much ever met. So I'm very, very thankful to him and to Rob. I mean, Roger booked his flight several days early, you know, like he had to spend extra time in Knoxville. It's a cool town. There's lots to do here, but you know, like that was really, really special. So I think it does communicate the very unique sort of love and respect and admiration that both of those guys and their colleagues on the cast have for their fans. I'll share one other moment from the class. The very first semester, no one knew what this was going to be like. I mean, I didn't even know until like a week before the class. I hadn't like finalized the syllabus, but I'll never forget the very first day of class. There were about 65 students signed up for the class. This little classroom is completely full at this point. I wanted to make it a really powerful impression on them, like in the very first 5 minutes, that would communicate what the class was all about. So what I decided to do before I even introduced myself, before I said a single word in the class, I turned off the lights and I showed them a slideshow that I had made that was meant to give them a sort of emotional impression as to what the class would be about. And what I did in this like 4-minute slideshow is that I tried to replicate the loading screens of Red Dead Redemption 2. You know how they use these like really cool stylized photographs from the kind of, you know, 1899 moment. And then it has this kind of like bleed effect where it goes from one to, you've watched hours and hours of this era, right? If you played so many hours, you know the loading screen. Everyone who's watching this knows those loading screens. So I tried to replicate that feeling, but not with fake photographs, but with real photographs from 1899. So on the Library of Congress's archive, there's an incredible collection of free open access to the public imaging. So I made a slideshow with the bunch of images from that. And then, of course, in the background, I played a song from the soundtrack of the game. I think it's like the Outlaws theme, where it's like, you know, the kind of spaghetti Western theme. Mm-hmm. So like, as soon as the lights came back on and they'd watched that, A, they knew that their professor had indeed played and loved Red Dead Redemption 2, and that this was going to be a real class. We were not seeing Micah Bell. We were seeing, you know, a church in New Orleans in 1898 or something like that. So that very brief slideshow, I feel like, gave it, this is a serious class, but your professor knows and loves Red Dead 2.
Yeah.
Right. That was what I wanted to get across. So that really kicked off the first day in a very successful way.
So now we're going to get into all about the book, as if we haven't already talked a ton about it already, but these are very specific questions. So to begin with...
Thank you for reading, by the way. Thank you so much.
Oh my gosh.
It means a lot to me.
Listen, even if I hadn't been, I might have taken like one extra day to read it if I hadn't been plowing through it after getting my copy at Comic-Con last weekend and knowing we were going to do this tonight, but it still wouldn't have taken me that much longer because to be fair, as a history major, I've read some pretty dry texts, but even after graduating college, I've still continued to read like biographies and historical texts and everything that are probably like a little more meant for the public. Like I do love Ghost Soldiers by Hampton Sides. It's a great World War II book. But anyway, so in Red Dead's history, you, of course, focus quite a bit on what the game got right or sort of right or, well, not right at all. So I'm obviously curious what your overall thoughts are on how many of the game's accuracies or inaccuracies were on purpose. For instance, not wanting to give players the ability to make decisions around lynchings or needing, and this is probably more my opinion than anything else, needing to set it in 1899 due to timeline issues that could or would have arisen otherwise, as they were, including John and Dutch, who were in the first game, versus a lack of historical research on the part of the developers.
Well, as I say in the book, and I do stand by it, despite all the things the game gets wrong or only half right, I think it does more to help rather than hurt historical understanding. Like, I think it is a good thing for historical awareness in America that Red Dead Redemption 2 exists. Like, if there was no Red Dead's history book or anything, right? Like, I think it's a force of good, ultimately, when we balance everything. Now, when it comes to the question of historical accuracy, Red Dead 2 and 1, they are able to very cleverly sort of circumnavigate that old accuracy question that people often have about video games that are historically based, because they fictionalize almost everything, just like Rockstar has done with the Grand Theft Auto game. Miami is not Miami, it's Vice City, you know, that sort of thing.
Thinly veiled.
Thinly veiled, but sometimes it's a little more difficult, you know, like, what is New Hanover? What state is that? I don't really know, you know, it's a little slippery. New Austin. So they're able to kind of walk the tightrope more effectively than, say, Assassin's Creed, which is much more explicit about using the names of real people and places and institutions. The names of almost everything in the Red Dead games is fictionalized, right? Except for the Pinkertons. The Pinkertons are not fictionalized at all, which is kind of interesting. They were a real thing by that name. So they're able to walk around this in a way that makes it hard to criticize them. Mm-hmm. I still do criticize the game in many ways. I kind of have to, you know, as a historian. But like I said, I think the game, at the scales tilt, it does more good than bad. But you're right, like the setting, you know, one of the most consistent critiques that I have in the book is that Red Dead 2 is a pretty great game about the early 1870s, but it's set in 1899, which doesn't make any sense for many of the topics. The Pinkertons are mainly busting up labor unions by 1899. They're not chasing many outlaws at that point. There are no bison left to hunt in the United States in 1899. Not none, but there's like literally 800 of them in the whole country. You know, so they're not like teeming on the Great Plains like they are pictured in the game. That would have made much more sense in the early 1870s. But I do think you're right, Tara, that one of the key reasons why they set it fairly close, 12 years from Red Dead 1, is they want to catch, you know, John Marston when he's younger, Dutch when he's younger. So I get it from that storytelling perspective, but it really does break some of the, you know, the nuances of the game in many ways.
A historical perspective anyway. I'm sure like you and I see things that other people are, and I do not mean this because this also sounds gatekeepy and I'm like, oh, we're historians. I'm not, by the way. I got a history degree 20 years ago and I have never once used that degree in my professional career in terms of like actual history, right? I have used things I learned while getting that degree.
Skills, but
not but not the history. So I'm not trying
until
to
today.
But I'm not trying to be gatekeepy in any way.
No, but you know, a lot of people who have neither a bachelor's or PhD in history care a lot about history and about historical representations. And a lot of fans of this game care a great deal. So you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to have fancy letters behind your name to be a historical critic of this stuff. I think you're entirely right. Now, there's the timing thing, like the 30 years off is one issue. But then there's other two huge silences in the game that are also kind of understandable why they're not there. Like there's two topics that would have been unavoidable in actual America of 1899, but are almost completely absent in Red Dead Redemption 2. And one of them is party politics. You know, we live in a divided moment in American political history. So did people in 1899. But party politics looked very different in 1899. There were some similarities. There was a lot of people fighting about immigration, you know.
Not from now. They look different maybe from Red Dead, but they don't look different from now. Just saying. Anyway, sorry. I'm not trying to interrupt you.
No, for sure. But so there's like no party politics in the game, which like you might think, oh, well, outlaws, they wouldn't have voted. They wouldn't have political opinions. No, they definitely would have. Voter turnout in the 1890s is much higher than it is today, proportionally based on eligible voting population. So it's very hard not to have a political identity in that period, especially Arthur. Arthur would have had a political identity in 1899, A, because he's critical of racial hierarchy, right? Like, he's pretty consistently anti-racist during the game. You know, he's like, he does not accept, you know, the sort of systems of white supremacy that existed at the time. That would have made him a political person just by definition, right? Like, he would have had firm opinions that would have been not completely rare, but somewhat outside of the norm in many ways. And so that would have made him political. And there is a great quote in Red Dead 2 when Arthur's like, why would anyone vote? You know, like, no, I'm not dumb enough to vote. No, he would have, you know, he might even have tried to vote knowing that he might have gotten arrested doing so. So that's totally absent. The other big thing that's absent in the game that was massively dominant in shadowing almost everyone's life was the labor movement. It was the question of organized labor, of workers forming unions and organizing. And that is, gets one, as far as I've seen, one reference in the game, like one line when Leviticus Cornwall is about to die. There's some mention of like unionization or labor movement, but that's it. However, you know, like Rockstar's got to be careful when they talk about labor unions because they're a big corporation themselves, right? They don't want to throw rocks in a glass house, if you know what I'm saying. So I'm not going to comment at all on their labor politics or anything. I don't know that much about it, but the absence of labor history in the game by a game made by a very large hierarchical corporation is not that surprising either. No, those are big absences, but I can understand why they're not there.
Following up on that, the book delves into some U.S. history, much of it the darker sort that was, if not misrepresented, then left out of RDR2, as you've already mentioned. If you could pick one inaccuracy and or thing that they didn't include that would have fit better with the 1899 timeline to be changed or added to the game, what would it be?
The central argument of my book, if there is one, I think there kind of is one, has to do with violence. So Red Dead 2 is, of course, a very violent game, just like pretty much every Rockstar game and pretty much every popular video game period today. It's a very violent game. I read one gaming website that estimated that the minimum number of people killed in Red Dead 2 under an honorable playthrough, right, where you're not harming civilians, is like 900. So that is a staggering number of bodies. I should note that only a handful of real historic outlaws even killed 10 people, you know? Yeah. So like, that is a bizarre exaggeration. Not surprising, again, you know, this is gamification of history, not the real representation. But the thing that I really explore so heavily in the book is, why did people shoot each other? Why did people knife each other or whatever? And in the game, most of the violence plays out not necessarily randomly, but because of personal factors, because of grudges, because of rivalries. And maybe most importantly, because of the personal pursuit of gain, right? Robberies, right? Like sticking up a bank or a stagecoach or a train or whatever. You know, that is the source of so many of the gunfights. Now, the real America of the late 1800s was also violent. Certain pockets of it were really violent, much more so than today. But what ignited and what fueled that violence in real America was much less whiskey, poker, gunfight, robberies, and rivalries. It was big social and political questions, political and economic dilemmas of the day. That's what quickened people's trigger fingers at the time. And the book really foregrounds two dilemmas that were the most common to spur violence, whether it was in the West or in the South or in Appalachia. The first has to do with the place of corporate capitalism, of these big new businesses that were mainly headquartered on the Eastern Seaboard, about what kind of power they would have over regular people's lives. That was an incredibly divisive question at the time. Yeah. It was a very new question because many Americans had never seen companies this big before, right? Like the Union Pacific Railroad or the Swift Meatpacking Company. Like, those were new institutions and many people really hated them and many people fight against them quite violently. Corporate capitalism is one dilemma that really fueled violence in the U.S. at this time period. But the other one that really fuels a lot of it is this unfulfilled promise of racial equality. Because with the end of the Civil War, the U.S. really redraws the founding documents of the country to allow Black men primarily to also participate in democracy. It makes these huge promises after the Civil War, but then the U.S. doesn't fulfill them, right? It doesn't fully enact them. And that is going to be the source also of tremendous violence, especially in the South, but not exclusively in the South. And so in the book, I take violence seriously, right? Like I don't mm-hmm. pretend that the U.S. was not violent. Instead, I use violence as a window to understand what these big social and political dilemmas were.
I will say, as from like a gamer's perspective, I think that you kind of already said, obviously Arthur Morgan, if he was like a real life outlaw in the 1800s, whether it was the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, whatever, he wouldn't have been killing 900 people. But this is also a game.
I'm not too concerned about that. The numbers are like, whatever. It's more like, what's fueling the violence?
Yes.
You know, that is something that I think is quite interesting and worth exploring.
Yeah, I think the Saint Denis stuff where they're up against the cops is probably more like realistic than most others. But moving on a little bit, which chapter of the book or comparison to the game was your favorite to write?
Well, since you were just talking about Saint-Denis and battles between outlaws and the police, I'm going to foreground my New Orleans chapter, which I really, really loved writing. So I zoom in on New Orleans right at that turn of the century moment when the game is set. And I take two moments that are really central to the game and try to shed light on what that actually looked like at the time. So the first are Sicilian immigrants. Right. So anyone who's played the game knows Angelo Bronte, you know, this kind of Sicilian mob boss that's running the city and all this. So I explore what was the actual, were there Italian immigrants, Sicilian immigrants in New Orleans at that exact moment? And the answer is, yeah, there were a lot of them, not just Italians, but 90% were Sicilians, which was unusually high within the United States. But the real story of Sicilians in New Orleans is not a story of them as victimizers of native-born residents, the way that Angelo Bronte is, but very much as victims of it. So in this chapter, I discuss one of the most infamous mass lynchings in American history, which takes place in 1891, and in which 11 Sicilian immigrants are lynched by a native-born white mob because they were suspected of having killed the police chief or being members of the mafia. There was no evidence linking them to that whatsoever. In fact, these guys had been acquitted in a court and then were lynched after the trial. So if the game is set in 1899, this would have been like 8 years after this massive, horrific lynching. The lynching, by the way, leads to the creation of the first Columbus Day in 1892, that the U.S. president declares like, hey, we got to have Columbus Day, because Columbus Day was meant to acknowledge the contributions of Italians to America. And it was done.
Contributions. I'm sorry. What was that again? Yeah. Smallpox. And
well, yeah. I mean, it's so funny. You know, there's so much criticism of Columbus Day in the last generation or so, but you know, the original motivation behind the holiday, sure, 400-year anniversary of Columbus coming, but it was very much triggered by what had gone down in New Orleans the previous year. Because the Italian government is like, wait, you're lynching our citizens? Like, this is completely illegal and bizarre. So there's a lot of animosity between Italy and the U.S. because of this episode in New Orleans in that very same decade, which is totally mind-blowing to think about.
Yeah.
So that's one element of the chapter. And then I won't go into as much depth here, but, you know, because so much of this, the time in Red Dead 2 in Saint-Denis is spent fighting these blue-coated police officers, right? Because there's no rival gang in Saint-Denis. Everyone you're shooting, basically, are the police. I do explore a real shootout between an outlaw, quote-unquote, and the New Orleans Police Department, not in 1899, but in 1900. In the summer of 1900, there is a tremendous bloodbath of a man, an outlaw. I mean, he's a criminal. He's a murderer. He kills, I think it's like 5 or 6 members of the New Orleans Police Department and multiple members of the crowds that were pursuing him. And there were literally gunfights that are even bigger than those of Red Dead 2. I mean, like one guy taking on a mob of thousands. Yeah. Robert Charles is the name of the outlaw. But when you read it in the book, you'll find out that it's a very different story from Red Dead Redemption 2. But it is a shootout, to be sure.
One of the lines that stuck out to me, and this is just one random sentence. One of the lines that stood out to me, and I'm not going to give any context because I don't think it really matters, but this tense intimacy of wealth and poverty lay at the heart of turn of the century New Orleans. And I wasn't going to bring it up, but since you said this was like your favorite chapter to write or whatever, I wanted to point out that I think that situation still exists, right? It's never changed. particularly in New Orleans. Like, as somebody who is a huge lover of New Orleans and its culture, I have family that lives there. I have been there more times than I can count at this point, and particularly with everything that's happened in New Orleans in the past, at this point, you know, 19-ish years. And of course, before then too, but I feel like that is something that I don't think you meant to portray like, oh, it hasn't, you know, it's different now or whatever. But I think that's a very important thing to point out, is that tense intimacy between poverty and wealth is still a huge thing in New Orleans. And I'm not saying it isn't anywhere else, but I feel like it is very,
it's really pronounced there.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I think Katrina, the hurricane, revealed that very yeah. closely, to be sure. Yep. But yeah, I mean, in many ways, that's kind of a very all-American story. Mm-hmm. Not that it's a good story, but it's very American. But it is so prominently on display in that city, right? I mean, that city is such a bundle of contradictions. It's such an amazing place, and it's such a, you know, horrifying place in many ways.
Moving on, as a once student, like literal student, I feel like I'm still always a student because I have continued reading and whatnot. You know, I still love watching, reading, and listening to podcasts and everything. But as a once literal student of history myself, and someone who has continued to enjoy consuming historical texts and whatnot, I loved that I still learned some new things when reading your book. And I assume that you also learned at least a few new things in the research you did for your class and or Red Dead's history. So I wanted to ask, what would you say was the most interesting or most amusing new thing that you learned?
Absolutely. There were so many moments, you know, Western, Southern Appalachian history that I did not know coming in, that I did not know 3 years ago before teaching the class. So it's been such a joy to learn new stuff. I mean, that's like the most amazing experience, you know, like learning does not end when you graduate. If it does, I feel bad for you. How about that? I think the key to longevity and happiness is to keep learning new stuff all the time. There's one moment that I only inserted into the book, like on the very last revision of it, and it still blows my mind. And it's a small detail. You might not think of it as, you know, totally consequential, but to me, it's very meaningful. So it's just one small detail from this very famous court case in 1896, Plessy versus Ferguson, right? This kind of infamous Supreme Court case that says that racial segregation is legal as long as facilities are equal, you know, which they never were. But it's basically green lights the institution of Jim Crow, which would then remain in place for like 65 years. And in the Supreme Court case, right, we had 9 justices, just like we do today. Back then, all of them were white men, not surprisingly, but it was not unanimous. There was one dissenter, and he was from Kentucky, and he was a former slaveholder. This guy who's formerly owned enslaved people from Kentucky, from a southern state, dissents to the rest of the judges, many of whom are not southern, right? Most of them who were northern, you know, city-based people, and tells them this is absolutely against the definition of America. This is not a country founded upon, you know, hierarchies of race. This is, it's totally goes against what this nation stands for. I love that moment because, you know, this is like, it's totally paradoxical. Like, who would expect this guy? Well, he has a conversion during his life and, you know, comes to see things very differently as a result of the Civil War and everything that happens after it. Harlan was his name, John Marshall Harlan, which is interesting. You know, Harlan's a big Kentucky name, Harlan County, all this sort of thing. So John Marshall Harlan dissents. And it kind of shows that sometimes we excuse too much of the past by saying, oh, people's mindsets were just different back then. You know, everyone believed that, you know, all white people believed that racism was okay, so we can't hold people against that standard. No, there were people who did not believe it, and they didn't hide their feelings. Like, they were vocal opponents of this. And so this was not passed unanimously. And that Harlan, of all people, is the one saying this cannot be the future. Is so interesting. So I did not know that until literally like a year ago. So that blew my mind.
I mean, it really speaks to the ideas of like educating a person and how
people can change.
How education and the just general evolving of a person. I mean, I'll be honest, like I was raised in a very small farm town by a very conservative Baptist family, weirdly enough, in Connecticut. Ask me how that happened. I don't know Baptist.
No. It's part of Connecticut history too, to be sure.
I mean, Protestant, sure, but Baptist, that's way different. Trust me. Like, and I was one of very few people that I knew that was raised Baptist. Very, very few. Most of my friends were Methodist, Lutheran, or Catholic. But all of that said, like the way I was raised, I went to college and it was like, you know, those things don't necessarily stick with you as long as you have a way to learn otherwise. And clearly this gentleman did. And I like that a lot. I like that there was that the one person who actually spoke against it was somebody who had actually been a former slaveholder. It's important, I think.
It just shows the complexity of the past, yes. Right? Like, there's not a simple black and white story of what happened.
Well, and I think it's the complexity of right? People, period.
Human nature is, we need to give it more credit than sometimes we do.
So I know that you had previously written academic texts, but while very educational, this book is obviously written for a much wider audience. And I am not saying that in any negative manner, right?
I take it in every positive manner. Yeah, that's exactly what I tried to do.
Listen, I read this in 4 days and I've read some other like historical texts that aren't meant to be academic, but still were slower than this.
Tara, I'll just say the way that I was able to make that transition, because anyone who reads my first book, and I don't encourage you to do so necessarily, but anyone who reads the first book and then goes to this one is like, whoa, this is like a different guy who's written it. Mm-hmm. What really changed me as a writer was the classroom, like was my teaching persona. Because mm-hmm. I realized like, wait, I do know how to reach 21-year-olds. I do it every Tuesday and Thursday. You know, like I literally am speaking to these people and getting them excited about history. Why couldn't I do that on the page? So in the book, you really hear my teaching voice, my teaching persona, right? There's shorter chapters, right? There's 20 chapters in this book. My first book had 6 chapters. It was way longer than this book and it was 6 chapters. This one is 20 chapters. I use much more active verbs, not passive verbs. I use really colorful, adjectives and rich description and lean into the storytelling side, let the characters shine. I wanted to make this a fast-paced and, engaging read. So the fact that you're able to tear through it in 2 or 3 days, that is the highest compliment that I could receive.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I'm, again, a very fast reader. But that said, like, the book interested me, intrigued me. I wanted to keep going because I wanted to see, okay, well, what's the opinion on the next thing? How are you going to take this next thing and turn it on its head, et cetera? But, I mean, I was going to ask, like, do you feel that you, and you've kind of half answered this because you said that your time as a teacher is what shaped how you wrote this book, but do you feel that you also grew as a writer through its creation?
Oh, so much. Yeah. I don't think I can write a book like my first book again. I don't think I really want to. I mean, like, I plan on writing more academic stuff for academic audiences, but I just don't want to go back to that kind of like inside baseball jargon that I still was kind of suffocated by in that book. I mean, I'm not saying that all academics should write like Red Dad's history. No, like that's not the point. This book is based on so many scholarly monographs. Like you flip through the footnotes here, it is so dependent on much denser historical scholarship. But what I see as my job with this book is really being an ambassador, traveling outward from my discipline and trying to excite new people about the weird complexities of American history. Mm-hmm. So I'm very much dependent on that kind of academic literature, but I don't know that I want to go back to writing it right away, at least. Check in with me in 10 years and I'll tell you where I'm at. But it's been very rewarding to write this book. And it's been rewarding to, like, you know, to engage with people who read your work. And, you know, I don't think all that many people read my first book comparatively. So it's fun doing the other way too.
Last thing about the book specifically, what is one thing you were not able to fit into Red Dead's history that you wish you could have and or hope to write about in the future?
Yeah. Well, I've already mentioned my regret that Guarma and the Caribbean and American imperialism is not part of the book. But I think the thing that really hurts more is Mexico and the Mexican Revolution, because I actually wrote a lot of lectures on that very topic. My original book proposal included 4 more chapters at the end about Red Dead 1 and the Mexican Revolution. But in the interest of space and in the interest of time and in the interest of keeping a sort of, you know, U.S. focus on it, I decided to cut those chapters. And maybe an expanded edition of this could come out in the future. I don't know if there's a market for that or not.
A DLC.
Yeah, exactly. A DLC for the book. I love that. I don't know. Yeah, so I have regrets about that, to be sure, because you know there's so many other topics that the games can help shed light on, and I only get, you know, some of them. Some other historian could write. And there actually has been other books about Red Dead Redemption in history. They haven't been as kind of publicly pitched in the way that mine has, but others have thought and written about this. So this is not like the final statement on this topic. It's one of the first statements, you know, but there'll be more to come, I'm sure. And I hope there is.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so one last thing before we get onto like some recommendations. In-person exploration. We, of course, met in Deadwood at the Black Hills Redemption event this summer. But have you visited any other locations that you think Rockstar might have used as inspiration or, you know, practically copied in miniature, like New Orleans as Saint Denis? Is the answer yes or no? I'm assuming it's yes.
No, the answer is no, actually.
Really?
I mean, Deadwood's really the first kind of destination.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to New Orleans plenty of times, but it's been before I got into this project. So I haven't returned there. I know you have, Tara. I read your entire narrative about it. It was amazing. But no, I've not traveled widely to try to see. Well, I shouldn't say that. The stuff that's set in Appalachia, it's not that I travel there. I kind of live in it.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah. Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, or to, you know, West Virginia, and see some of the places that, you know, the game tries to evoke with the Roanoke Ridge, Butcher Creek sort of elements of the game. Mm-hmm. But no, I haven't like gone on like Red Dead road trip. It would be fun, but I don't know if I could convince my 6 and 9 year old daughters to come along because I have not let them watch Red Dead Redemption 2.
Well, I did see in your acknowledgments, I think it was, that you haven't let them watch too much
of
you
play
the
game,
but that they call it the horsey game. And I just have to tell you that when I first started playing the first Red Dead Redemption, my now ex-husband and I, who I'm still best friends with, so this is not a bad tale in any way, we call it horsey time. And we still, like, we'd been divorced like several years when the second game came out, but we're still very good friends and we're playing it. Sometimes he would like come visit me at my house and I'd be playing it, or I'd like let him play my game or whatever. And we've played Red Dead Online together and we've just still continuously called it horsey time. So yeah. I saw that and I was like, oh, horsey game, horsey time.
It's I'll tell you a funny story alongside that too. So when Roger and Rob came to visit me on campus back in March, I was not that annoying fan who asked them to make all these videos for my friends, but I did ask them for one video. I wanted them to make a video for my daughters and I asked them to call it the horsey game in the video.
Oh, that's
so
great.
There's an amazing video on my computer of Roger and Rob being like, hey cowpoke, where are the guys from the horsey game? So my daughters love that.
So because you played the game after visiting New Orleans and you haven't been back to New Orleans since, did you have some deja vu of seeing Saint Denis? Like, did you recognize some of those places?
Yeah. I mean, the docks on the river,
the
streetcars, like St. Charles Avenue, all that. Oh, yeah. I've been there and done that. I mean, I'm really looking forward to going back. The dream that I've always had is that this redemption gathering, first Tombstone, then in Deadwood.
Oh, you
that
and
it
both.
Goes to New Orleans, because that'd be such an amazing place to host
you
like a gathering
both.
Of fans.
Yeah.
So I'm pushing for that, to be sure.
Yeah.
It'd be an incredible space.
I agree. So because you haven't been to any other places other than Deadwood, what places would you like to visit other than New Orleans again that likely or just straight up did inspire certain game locations? Do you have any?
Yeah.
Or I'm a traveler, so I always like asking people these questions.
Yeah, maybe like a plantation district in Cuba or like the Dominican Republic or something. I imagine that was probably, you know, the Guarma inspiration. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like in the book, I don't delve that deep into like what's the real life equivalent of like Blackwater. It didn't strike me as obvious, you know, like St. Louis, maybe. I don't really know. Like,
so
to me, New Orleans, Saint Denis was so obvious, you know, but some of like Valentine, that could have been so many different towns.
Literally,
you know, it's
yeah.
like a sort of like cattle boom town in the West. You know, there were so many places that could have stood in for. I don't think there's one neat equivalent.
Well, I think like in the first game, it's a little more obvious. Like Armadillo is Surely Amarillo.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it even looks like if you look up old pictures of Amarillo, it's like super freaking obvious. And plus the name, let's be real. And I think Tumbleweed was probably supposed to be closer to like Tombstone, Arizona. So it's the map is very contained and they're fitting a whole bunch of places. I mean, even the area that's supposed to resemble Appalachia, when you go farther north in it, that's not Appalachia. Those mountains are way too tall. You know, all right. Well, last bit, recommendations. I am sure you have plenty of great recommendations for like academic text or whatever, probably as a
just look through the footnotes of my book, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, you can read all the greatest hits.
But I would love if you could to recommend, you don't have to recommend all of them, but any or all the following. One, do you have a historical nonfiction book that you've enjoyed that was written with a wider audience in mind, like yours was?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's a little on the long side, but it's totally engaging. It's totally mind-blowing. I learned so much reading it. It's called Buffalo Bill's America by Lewis Warren. Okay. And it is a biography of Buffalo Bill, William Cody, who does more than any single figure to popularize this idea of a Wild West. I mean, some people claim he even invents the phrase. He had his Wild West show. He was probably the most famous person in the world in the 1890s or so. Mm-hmm. But his life is filled with complete paradoxes. Like, he defies every stereotype you would imagine. He just has such an insane life that it's worth like a 500 page biography. So Buffalo Bill's America is just like, if you're a Wild West, you know, obsessive, read this book and you will never think about the Wild West the same ever again.
Okay, well, I'm going to add that to my list. Do you have a movie and or TV series that's based on historical events that doesn't sacrifice a ton of accuracy while still being riveting would be great, but I'll settle for a good watch if need be.
I think a lot of American historians on this question for kind of like the late 19th century would probably go with Deadwood. Deadwood is, HBO is very good at doing this kind of thing. Deadwood is the excellent kind of rural Western counterpart. And then I do like, as for a newer show, The Gilded Age on HBO as well,
yes.
Which is great.
I was wondering if you would like it or not, because I was thinking about mentioning it and I was like,
You know, I wish it wasn't so much about the social politics of rich people in New York. You know, like they're like, the great divide is between the old rich and the new rich. I'm like, no, that's not the great divide of America. That's between the rich and the poor, you know, who are there, you know. But I mean, it's a good show. I really enjoy watching it. I do have like, you know, a couple of friends who are also historians of the Gilded Age and Progressive Era. And we've chatted about it a decent bit. And, you know, it's not perfect, but the second season is better than the first, actually. The second season diversifies the cast more in terms of class and background and race. You know, there's some really great episodes in the South that explore kind of African-American history in that age of Booker T. Washington, who's such a towering figure then. So I like the Gilded Age. So yeah, I like Carrie Coon a lot too. She's really awesome, who plays the, you know, matriarch of the nouveau riche family. She's amazing.
Yeah, I've very much enjoyed Gilded Age. I mean, and also it's basically Downton Abbey. It's Downton
Abbey. American version.
But the American version, yeah. Right. I mean, also set quite a bit earlier, but okay. One other piece of media, a book, a podcast, a movie, a series that doesn't fit into either of the above categories, but that you just love. Just something you've been super into in the past or recently.
I'll tell you the best historical fiction book that I've read in the last few years.
Okay.
And it's not going to be shocking. It's like a very popular book. But as a historian, I think it's really good, which is All the Light We Cannot See, which is set in World War II, Europe, France, and Germany mainly.
Yep.
Such an amazing book. I mean, I guess there's a Netflix series on it now, but I haven't seen it yet. But I love that book. Oh my gosh. It was really emotionally powerful. And me and, you know, the 900,000 other people who read it. It can't be wrong, right?
I haven't read it.
You really should.
I watched the Netflix series. It's one of those books that is like, oh, it was on my list, but then the series came out and Dean, he doesn't read a ton of like historical fiction. So I was like, oh, let's just watch this. And I do have it like on my list.
Did you like it?
I thought it was good. Yeah. I don't know how accurate it was to the book, but it was good. Okay. So I'm going to real quick give two recommendations myself. I was actually going to give three, but you already recommended The Gilded Age, which that was going to be my like wild card recommendation. Yeah. And now it doesn't have to be a wild card. Yay. I'm going to give two recommendations myself based on if you like Red Dead's history and felt yourself nodding along, particularly with your writings about post-Civil War Black history and your thoughts on the depictions of Appalachia. The first is a nonfiction book. It's called Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present by Harriet A. Washington. I have nothing else to say other than I don't want to say it's an easy read because it's not an easy read because it's some dark ass shit. I would say, excuse my language, but I swear a lot on my podcast. So it's some dark action.
We've had a very tame session here, haven't we?
Yes, for me, yes.
Given all the violence that we're talking about.
But it is a very, very, very good book. It was required reading actually by my job. But if they had just told me like, hey, here's this book, you should check it out, I would have anyway. And it's historical in that it goes, like I said, back to colonial times, but it's very good. And it's written for the masses, I guess I would say, if in terms of like, it's not like a super academic dry text. So it's very good. Have you read it before?
I haven't, but I've heard of it.
It's really good. I would highly suggest
similar, like kindred books in that field. Yeah.
The other one is a fiction book. It's called Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver. Have you read that one?
My wife's read it. It's like probably on the shelf behind me.
Yeah.
I just haven't had the time to do it. It obviously was like the book of the year for almost everyone last year. And I know it's about Appalachia. It's part of it takes place in Knoxville where I live. So I'm looking forward to reading it.
I used to love Barbara Kingsolver. One of my favorite books of all time is one of her books. Oh my God. Poisonwood Bible. Was one of my favorite books of all time. It's very dark. It's like missionaries in Africa. Missionaries in Africa. And it like does justice to the fact that, ooh, why are you doing this, guys? Why you like this, guys? But yeah, Demon Copperhead, it's a heart-wrenching, but at times still uplifting look at the life of a young boy growing up in Appalachia, southwestern Virginia, to be specific, is where most of the book takes place. It is set in more modern times, like the 1990s through like maybe the early 2000s, but it has some really great insight into how so many in the U.S. still to this day have the opinion that, to sort of quote your book, the mockery of poor rural whites, especially from the southern mountains, is like totally okay. So
our current vice presidential nominee for the Republican Party has made his career on that very topic. So these are not topics of no significance. They matter. I think I haven't read Kingsolver's book, but my gut sense is that it gives a much better vision of Appalachia, what makes it tick, than old J.D. Vance does. Though I also have three chapters on Appalachia here where I delve into many of those same questions.
Right. And to be honest, that's why I wanted to suggest Demon Copperhead, because it's like if you read Red Dead's history and you have any interest in further exploring, I mean, it's history of Appalachia, but it's more recent history. But they do in Demon Copperhead, there is some text about like the coal mines and everything and how that affected their whole region, and also the sort of the common situation where like, oh, well, so much of our subsistence comes from, even in the late 1900s, comes from hunting and fishing and stuff. It's a really good book. And it had been a long time since I had read a Kingsolver book. And I like could not put it down. Like, I'm pretty sure Dean was mad at me at some points because I was like, I was reading and he was like, let's watch stuff. And I was like, no, I'm reading, stop. Or just put something on and I'm ADHD, so I can watch and read at the same time. Okay. So, all right. Well, any other things you want to note before we close out?
I'm really eager to play Red Dead Redemption 3.
Oh my God. You and me both. Whenever it possibly, maybe, who knows, exists.
That might require a second edition of Red Dead's history.
A change.org petition.
Yeah, exactly. It'll come. I'm sure it will.
At this point, I'd be happy with like a DLC of Sadie and Charles bounty hunting in South America.
I think 5 years after release date, that window has likely closed.
Yeah, I know. Listen, let me have my educated wishes, as Deadpool would say.
Yeah. You might remember this in the book, in the epilogue, the very last chunk of it, I actually give my vision for what Red Dead 3 should look like. I'm sure it will have no bearing on what actually it looks like, but I would like to see the game actually go to the early 1870s, you know, where Red Dead 2 kind of wanted to be from the beginning, and explore things like Reconstruction, warfare between Native peoples and the government that's really, you know, at high tide at that moment. But it's just such a wild, quote unquote, moment in American history that I'd love to see the game engage it. And, you know, you go even further with the great historical work they did on the second game and go even further in the third. Maybe in a couple of years, or maybe a couple of years.
I was going to say, it was like, what, 8 years between Red Dead 1 and Red Dead 2? And they're currently
deep. We only got 3 years to go.
But they're currently deep into GTA 6. And they're not going to start working on anything else till that comes out, which worries me. But all right, as we close out the episode, just want to give a shout out to our heroes, to your patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. Thank you so much for supporting us. And thank you for joining myself and special guest Tori Olson for this interview and discussion born from our shared passions for history and Red Dead. Do not forget to follow Tori at Red Dead History on Instagram, and to, of course, place your book or audiobook order for Red Dead's history via any major bookseller or audiobook app. For the most current news and updates about the Geek Saga show / Geek Saga podcast, make sure to follow at Geek Saga on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, Threads, Twitter. But also please consider backing our Patreon at patreon.com/ Geek Saga _ entertainment. Thank you for listening to the Geek Saga podcast. If you like what you heard, please check out other Geek Saga entertainment endeavors, including the Sagas and Sass webcast and podcast, and Ice and Fire Con.